Judge, argument is United States versus Peel. Ms. Liu.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Early 2006 was a troubled time for Gary Peel.
You speak up, please. I can't hear you.
Early 2006 was a troubled time for Gary Peel. He was bankrupt and litigating three lawsuits against his ex-wife. To settle those lawsuits, he offered her five nude pictures of her 16-year-old sister, which he had taken when they were having an affair in 1974. The relationship might have been distasteful, but the photographs were legal when they were taken, and so was the relationship. The Peels then began negotiating a settlement, but unbeknownst to Mr. Peel, Mrs. Peel had called the authorities, and the FBI was directing and recording everything she said. Mr. Peel was arrested. He was convicted of bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, and two counts of possession of child pornography. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison, and he's already served almost three. In our briefs, we raised a number of challenges to Mr. Peel's convictions. In oral argument today, however, I would like to focus on our challenges to Mr. Peel's sentence. The district court...
A lot of other issues. You don't want to just talk about the sentencing. Really? That's all you want to talk about?
Well, Your Honor, I'd certainly like to run through our arguments on the sentence, but if the court would like to hear about the other issues, I'm certainly happy to address those as well.
Now, you can start with the sentence, if that's what you're particularly interested in.
Your Honor, the district court clearly erred in making two sentencing determinations. First, it found that the intended loss for the bankruptcy fraud and the obstruction of justice charge exceeded $1 million. Second, it found that the retail value of the pornography was between $400,000 and $1 million. Both of those findings were clear error. Let me explain briefly why that is. With respect to the intended loss, the district court included in that calculation the amount that Mr. Peel owed.
What do you think was the intended loss?
I think at most the intended loss was the $229,000 that Mr. Peel owed Mrs. Peel at the time he filed for bankruptcy, and the amount of the future payments under the marital settlement agreement, reduced to present value. I want to point out...
That's what the $229,000 is?
No, Your Honor. $229,000 was the amount that Mr. Peel
What's the other figure?
The other figure is the amount that Mr. Peel would have owed under the marital settlement agreement.
That's as opposed to adding up all of the cumulative month or quarterly or whatever they were paying.
Right. The district court made that calculation by looking at the...
I don't understand you. He owed $229,000 to his wife?
That's
correct. And what's this other number?
The other number, the $229,000 was what he owed already. He was in arrears in his payments.
What's the other number?
The other number is that under the marital settlement...
What is the other number?
$525,000 before reduction to present value.
Do you take the position that the district judge has to do present value calculations as part of the guideline calculation, particularly since we're talking about advisory guidelines anyway?
Your Honor, I think if the district... I do take that position.
Okay. Has that approach been taken by other courts that have required district judges to do that calculation?
I'm not aware of any cases that have required that. It is the general practice, Your Honor, and the district court was asked to do it by Mr. Peel's trial counsel and did not do it without giving any explanation why.
But that's the gross figure, $525,000?
Right.
And your argument should be discounted to present value?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's that?
$313,780. Document 178 in the record is the submission that the trial counsel made to the district court about that.
How do these figures differ from what the judge thought to calculate the loss to be?
The judge added, in addition to those two figures, added the entire amount that Mr. Peel owed his other creditors.
That's about $600,000 or so?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And presumably those are the creditors who would have benefited from an extortionate settlement with Mrs. Peel.
Those were the other creditors who, and it's a little unclear from the record exactly what effect the settlement would have had on them. It may well have benefited them if they were to receive more money. And
could I just ask you one more question about this the bankruptcy fraud loss calculation? And that is, in the guideline calculations, did that loss calculation drive the final result, or was it, or did the child pornography guidelines, in essence, trump all of the bankruptcy fraud calculations?
So in the way that this played out in the district court, the retail value finding for child pornography drove the sentence. This did not, the intended loss, of course, still affected the sentence because of the way that the grouping rules work under the guidelines.
How big was that effect, though?
There was a, it would have been a two-level difference.
Now, I know there's a two-level difference in terms of your bankruptcy numbers, but because of the grouping effects, if we were to agree with you on the bankruptcy fraud loss, would that change the net total guideline calculation if the child pornography calculations remained in effect?
If they remained in effect, no, it would not make a difference.
Okay.
With that, Your Honors, I'd like to move on to the retail value argument. The district court found that the retail value of the child pornography in this case...
I don't understand. This, how would his extortion have affected the other creditors? I don't understand. You obviously object to the judge adding this $600,000, don't you?
I do, and the argument is that his extortion would not have had any effect on the other creditors. What's more, Your Honor, Mr. Peel listed in his bankruptcy schedules assets of $500,000. About half of that amount was exempt. But the district court never took into consideration that, in fact, Mr. Peel had assets to satisfy his other creditors. Nonetheless, it counted everything he owed the other creditors as part of the intended loss in this case.
So you're saying that because even taking hers out, the $600,000+ would exceed his assets, so it would have been eligible for bankruptcy anyway?
Right. He would have been eligible for bankruptcy because his assets were unquestionably less than his liabilities.
Liabilities aside from what he owed her.
Right. But he did have assets that could have been used perhaps to satisfy some of those liabilities. And the district court said he intended to cause a loss of the entire amount that he owed his other creditors. We argue that that was error as well. With respect to the retail value...
Is there some theory floating around here that they didn't really have to declare bankruptcy, that he did it somehow in order to get out from under this obligation to his wife? Is that part of the judge's thinking?
There's no indication that I can think of, but perhaps Ms. Hudson will correct me, that was the judge's thinking. The judge simply said he was adding up the amount that Mrs. Peel gave up as a result of this settlement, and then he added up the entire amount of the other liabilities because the victim of the crime, he said, was the bankruptcy court itself. And therefore, he was simply going to take the full figure.
The bankruptcy court didn't lose any money.
Your Honor, that's completely in agreement with our argument. With respect to the retail value argument, our argument is a plain language argument. The sentencing guidelines require that if distribution is for pecuniary gain, that there would be an addition of five of levels corresponding to the retail value of the pornography. In this case, the district court said that the best estimate of retail value is the amount that Mr. Peel hoped to gain from distributing the pornography. That reasoning reads the word retail completely out of the guidelines. Our position is that, as the district court found, retail value of 30-year-old Polaroid photographs was limited at best. And, in fact, there was no evidence put on at trial whatsoever about the market value of the five Polaroids.
No, there was one buyer. We know one buyer said she was willing to pay that much, right?
Your Honor, retail value, argument is that the plain meaning of retail value is market value, not the amount that an idiosyncratic buyer might choose to pay for the photographs.
Is there, if we were to agree with you, the district judge obviously appreciated this issue, reflected on it, and decided to focus on what Mr. Peel sought to obtain in exchange for those photographs. If we were to agree with you, is there anything at all that would prevent the district court from just saying, under the circumstances of this court on remand, I'm going to use that same value as the basis, whether it's strictly within the guidelines or not?
Your Honor, it would certainly be flying in the face of the text of the guidelines, the retail value argument.
Well, this guideline obviously wasn't designed for this sort of extraordinary situation, a very unusual transaction.
It was certainly very unusual, if nothing else. But
I don't think retail value is your strongest argument. I think your strongest argument is that the guideline talks about distribution for pecuniary gain. This is not distribution. This is the opposite of distribution.
Well, Your Honor, that was also argued
before
the
district
court.
It's not that he's planning to sell it. And he says to her, you know, I'm going to sell this stuff, you know, make money on it, but, you know, you can, if you want it more, for even if you want to destroy it, okay, you can pay it for more. But apparently he wasn't interested in distribution.
It was not
a... Judge Hamilton says, you know, the judge, if this peculiar situation isn't envisaged by the guidelines, well, that gives the judge a lot of flexibility.
We can't argue with the fact that the guidelines are now advisory. If this were to go back before the district court, we would certainly argue that he was convicted of possession of child pornography, and this is the structure that the guidelines have set out for dealing with that offense. It may be, if this court disagrees with us on the bankruptcy fraud and the obstruction count.
This would be a very good situation for the judge not to be cabined by the guidelines, but instead to, you know, figure out for himself what would be an appropriate sentence. Given that there is money involved, it just isn't money in retail distribution.
But, Your Honor, if there's certainly money involved, but the argument would go that the amount that should be part of the calculation for bankruptcy fraud and obstruction of justice. Of course, we have substantive arguments that you should throw out those convictions as well, but if you disagree with us, those are the guidelines that capture the intended loss calculation is what captures the seriousness of this crime. The child pornography guidelines are addressing a completely different issue, and here you do perhaps have a way of capturing the amount of money that Mr. Peel allegedly sought to gain from this. Mm. Our argument, of course, is that both the bankruptcy fraud conviction and the obstruction conviction should fall by the wayside for the arguments we set forth in our brief.
Ms. Liu, could I ask you about your challenge to the child pornography convictions?
Yes.
My question, in essence, you're relying on an affirmative defense.
That's correct.
That was where there was no notice was given below. It was never addressed below, and I'm troubled by that, obviously, because I'm trying to think if there's any situation you're aware of where an appellate court has reversed a district court on an affirmative defense that was never raised below. I've never seen that before.
Your Honor, I can't say that I've seen it before either, but in this particular case, the very sparse case law on this issue shows that in a situation like this, the affirmative defense was forfeited rather than waived, and the proper thing for this court to do is to review it for plain error. And reviewing for plain error, the district court should have granted the motion for acquittal. If this court isn't comfortable with that, I suppose it's also possible that it could be remanded so that the arguments could be fully presented and briefed below.
Your position is, though, there's really no fact in dispute that's relevant.
There is no fact in dispute. The age And it is an unusual case, again, because in this case there's no dispute about when the photographs were taken, who the subject was, and how old the subject was in the photographs. So that decision is that question is ripe for decision now. Your Honor, I see that my yellow light has gone on.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe.
Thank you.
Ms. Hudson?
May it please the Court. The case against Gary Peel was one in which the District Court continually looked at Mr. Peel's complete lack of regard for the judicial system. Mr. Peel, an attorney, filed bankruptcy. Then he circumvented the court's ability, the trustee's ability, to regulate that bankruptcy by taking these nude photographs of a 16-year-old girl.
I don't understand. There's no harm to the other creditors, is there?
Your Honor, I think what the district court was looking at...
I'm asking you, was there any harm to the other creditors?
Not...
Was there any other harm to the other creditors?
Not directly.
What do you mean directly? What was the indirect harm to other creditors?
The process itself.
What was the indirect harm to other creditors?
The process itself, Your Honor.
Well, I don't understand you. Did they lose a penny because of this extortion?
Not at this point, no.
What do you mean at this point? Is there some future point at which they might lose a penny from this extortion?
At the time of the trial, the
answer my question.
I don't know.
I don't understand. I do not see how it is conceivable that the other creditors can be hurt by this extortion.
They will benefit, though. Not
Excuse
hurt.
Me?
As I see it, the potential could be that they benefit.
That they benefit?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's conferred a benefit on them, but you're going to... I don't get it.
If I can explain...
You confer a benefit on them, and that becomes a basis for...
If I can explain, Your Honor, I
apologize. ...intended loss?
The court in this instance did look at the process itself. It found that the bankruptcy court was the victim because...
The bankruptcy court didn't lose anything, didn't lose any money.
The case at the court...
The $600,000 has no relation to anybody, any loss sustained by anybody.
The district court explained that relying on MUTIC, M-U-T-U-C, that the bankruptcy proceeding itself, the judicial proceeding, had been harmed by the end run.
But not to the extent of $600,000. That's a completely arbitrary figure.
The court relied upon the case I referenced.
It doesn't make any sense because it's not a measure of harm to anybody. I have another question.
Yes, sir.
I don't understand your argument that the bankruptcy fraud and the obstruction are somehow you can be convicted of both of them because if you're guilty of obstruction of justice and there's a bankruptcy proceeding, you're going to be automatically guilty of bankruptcy fraud, aren't you?
If you are found guilty of obstruction of justice, will you automatically be found guilty of a bankruptcy fraud if there is a bankruptcy proceeding? The appellant has argued no. In their brief, they indicated that under 152 subsection 6, it must be shown specifically under Title 11.
I'm not talking about that. Look, I'm talking about the double jeopardy issue.
I understand.
And the question is whether there's any way in which you could, if you commit a murder, then you've automatically committed an attempted murder, and you can't be punished for both of them.
Correct.
Well, if you commit an obstruction of justice in a bankruptcy proceeding and violating the obstruction of justice statute, then you have to have also committed bankruptcy fraud, don't you?
There are two issues at play. First, the corrupt nature of it.
That's my question. Is there any way in which you can be guilty of obstruction of justice in a bankruptcy proceeding without also being guilty of bankruptcy fraud?
Yes, for two reasons. One, corrupt. Two, subsection 6 requires that there be an action under Title 11.
In this case, though.
I'm sorry?
In this case, how could he be convicted of both of those crimes? What facts separate those proofs?
I apologize. In looking at the specific facts, the Blockberger test indicates that should not be done, that it should be done in isolation. In this case, the same facts are being used to establish two different crimes. The court is correct in making that statement.
There's no difference.
It's not a separate element, though. Isn't bankruptcy fraud is broader than obstruction, isn't it? If you have a bankruptcy fraud, within that is also obstruction.
Obstruction is broader than bankruptcy fraud. I agree with that. Yes.
Well, wait a minute. Isn't all the elements of bankruptcy fraud, doesn't that add up to obstruction?
If the facts of the case show corrupt, then yes.
I don't understand. Show corrupt.
Fraud without corruption? Corruption without fraud? Is that the idea?
Yes.
I don't understand. Here you have an extortion. It's an obstruction of justice. It's also bankruptcy fraud, isn't it?
In this particular case, absolutely.
Well, then I don't see what the separation is between the crimes. It's like the attempt and the murder. Once he's guilty of murder, he has to be guilty of attempt. Once Peel is convicted of obstruction of justice, given the facts, picking up on what Judge Hamilton was saying, on the facts of this case, his obstruction of justice conviction automatically determined that he had violated bankruptcy fraud. There wasn't any extra thing to show beyond the obstruction to make him guilty of bankruptcy fraud.
The Blockberger test looks at the elements as opposed to the facts. Well, I agree
with
the
court. But is there a separation? Is there some way in which... if he'd been convicted of obstruction in this case, is there any way in which he could have been exonerated of bankruptcy fraud?
Yes, if we did not show that it was the case under Title 11.
Yes, I know, but since that has been shown, is there any way in which... I mean, that's like saying in a murder and attempt case, if you didn't show he was a murderer, then you could convict him of attempted murder. But if you convicted him of being a murderer, you can't convict him of attempted murder, right? Is that correct? Or am I wrong? You have to answer my question, not fence with me.
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not trying to fence with you.
Fence with me. That's what lawyers do. Now, my case is you murder someone and you're charged with murder and attempt. Can you be convicted both of murder and of attempt?
I cannot think of something at this point that would
answer
show...
Answer my question,
no.
Yes or no.
No.
No, you cannot. Now, in this case, if you're convicted of obstruction of justice in a bankruptcy proceeding, is there any way in which you somehow might not be guilty of bankruptcy fraud?
Not under these facts. But the Blockberger test looks at the elements, not the specific facts. And I
But the elements in attempt and murder are different, aren't they?
They should be. There should be an attempt as opposed to a completion of the act.
They have different elements.
Correct.
And yet you admitted you can't convict a person both of the murder and of the attempt. So there's something wrong with your test. Now try to make sense of that. Different elements of murder and attempt. But you say you can't convict the person of both.
Then apparently I was
wrong. How is that different from this case?
Then apparently I was wrong. At my understanding of
Blockberger... You're wrong? You think you can convict a person both of murder and of attempt? No.
Okay.
If you think that, you're wrong. That's basic. That's the basic example that's given of double jeopardy.
Ms. Hudson, could I ask you about the defense is relying on this issue on the McCullough case. I didn't see that addressed in your brief. Did you have some thoughts about it? It's a case that they rely on heavily, which suggests that, in essence, in this kind of situation, the fact that you might theoretically be able to commit one crime without committing the other, you still need to look at the facts of this particular case.
If looking at the facts of the particular case, then yes, you are looking at an instance where they are both the same thing.
Could I ask you a question about the affirmative defense to the child pornography charges? It, as near as I can tell, the government's proof proved that defense. Is there any fact that would actually be in dispute on that defense if we were to remand the case?
I don't believe we proved that defense.
You proved that the subject of the photographs was 16 years old, legally an adult, at the time the photographs were produced.
My disagreement with that, Your Honor, is not that she was 16 at the time they were produced. My disagreement is that the law that governs this instance is the law that was in effect in January of 2006.
Of course.
And if you look at the logical consequence of the defendant's assertion, when you an individual in this society has the right to know what the law of the land is. If I am a particular person, I have a piece of paper with an image of a 16-year-old girl on it in a pornographic image. I need to know then whether or not the picture was taken before 1984 or after, and if it's in 1984, what particular date, in order to know whether or not I am guilty of a crime. Mm-hmm. That leaves a lot of uncertainty as to who that person is, when the picture was taken, and as the court's well aware, most of the individuals who are in these pictures, the time and the date and the location is unknown. So for the purpose of allowing the general public to know if their crimes are actually crimes, looking at this for January of 06 is appropriate.
Well, of course we look at it as January 06, but we've got a statutory affirmative defense that says in this situation, where the subject was an adult at the time it was produced, if the defendant can prove that, and in this case you proved it, there's a defense.
But I think at the subject was an adult is the issue. And what is the definition of adult? There's no definition within the guideline, but there is a definition, of the statutory scheme, but there is a definition for minor, and minor is anyone under the age of 18.
Well, if that's your interpretation, then that statutory affirmative defense, I think, would disappear. Can there be any situation where it would apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you have to prove the subject is under the age of 18.
Yes, Your Honor. That, in fact, the affirmative defense that the defense or the appellant is using applies to individuals where you have youthful-looking adults who are posing these pictures.
No, that's not a violation if they are right. Above the age of 18, right?
That's correct, and that's what this defense is for.
No. To prove your case, you have to prove the subject was under the age of 18 at the time the image was produced.
Correct.
You're telling me the defense applies only if the subject was above the age of 18, in which case you haven't proved your case. It's a redundant defense.
In this instance, I'm saying that the definition of adult is determined based upon the law in effect at the time of the offense, and that's January of 06.
And give me an instance where that would apply, where the government can prove its case, its own case.
Well, in this instance, to distinguish between the two photographs, the photograph that was given to Mrs. Peel on the 20th of January was a photocopy that Mr. Peel made in his office or on a 3-in-1 printer that was produced at evidence in January of 2006. That production was of a 16-year-old girl, and he then placed that in her mailbox. Now, that's the original photograph was taken in 1974, but then reproduced onto that paper.
Was he charged with production?
No, he was not. He was charged with possession.
Straight possession.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Suppose that someone had child pornography that had been created by a computer rather than, it wasn't a real photograph of anybody. It was a computer simulation. So would the government, if there weren't this defense, would the government be able to convict someone for possession of child pornography?
A computer-generated image?
Yes.
I believe that's already been found.
I'm asking you a question. No. And what about if it's a 30-year-old who looks like a 12-year-old?
this is the defense for that person.
Now, wait a second. So you're saying you could prosecute someone for child pornography if the person in the picture was 30, if she looked like a child?
No, Your Honor, I apologize.
Couldn't.
Right.
Well, then this is Judge Hamilton's question. What work does this affirmative defense do?
It protects... I'm sorry.
Yeah. What does it protect?
It protects individuals just as you've described.
No. But... No. That's not a defense. You have to prove that it's a real child.
Right.
So what does this defense do? If that's part of your burden of proof, in what case would this defense have any consequence?
I believe the instances Your Honor has described.
Well, speak up. I can't.
I believe the instances Your Honor has described. If the government mistakenly believes an individual is 12, we've made an error, we indict a person, they come forward and say, hey, this person is 30 years old, it's simply a youthful-looking adult, then absolutely this person has a defense.
No, you're wrong. That's not an affirmative defense. That's something you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So if the defendant says to you, look, this girl was not 12, she was 30, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was 30. It's not an affirmative defense. Affirmative defense is something the defendant has to prove. So now where's the case where a defendant would have to prove something within the scope of this provision in order to be exonerated?
Looking at Mr. Peel's second production, the photograph that was copied onto the copy paper and then given to Mrs. Peel, had that individual actually been 30 at the time, then he would avail himself of this particular...
No, you would have... You have to prove that it's a child. That's your burden of proof. That's not an affirmative defense. Affirmative defense is something like a statute of limitations. You prove that it's child pornography... The defendant proves that it was taken, you know, that you took too much time which to prosecute. Let me ask you another question. Judge Hamilton mentioned the McCullough case. In the McCullough case, it says that if proof of the greater offense invariably will prove the lesser offense, Then you have a double jeopardy problem. Isn't this a case where to prove the greater offense, they had to prove that he had committed this obstruction of justice, and you know, obstruction of justice had to occur in some sort of legal proceeding, it happened to be a bankruptcy proceeding. That's what they prove. Having proved that, didn't that invariably prove the bankruptcy fraud?
In this case, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Hudson. So, Ms. Liu, your time... Well, do you have a little more time? So, anyway, you can take what you need.
Your Honor, I have one point that I'd like to address briefly, unless the Court has other questions. That was Ms. Hudson's statement that the government proved that there was a case under Title 11. The government did prove that there was a case under Title 11. It did not, however, prove that Mr. Peel bribed Mrs. Peel to act or forbear to act in such a case. The only cases that he was asking her to settle were the two adversary proceedings and the state court, family court action. Those, as we argued in our brief, are not cases under Title 11, and therefore the bankruptcy fraud conviction cannot stand.
Didn't he specifically ask her, though, to stop all proceedings in the bankruptcy court on those issues as one of his conditions?
Your Honor, the adversary proceedings are proceedings in the bankruptcy court. They're filed in the bankruptcy court, but they're not a case under Title 11. They're separate ancillary civil proceedings, adversary proceedings.
Why do you think Congress would have drawn that line that you're arguing exists?
Your Honor, it's not clear, certainly from the face of the statute, and we haven't been able to find a crystal clear answer to that. But one reason might be that The statute is drawn narrowly so that all sorts of negotiations which may be going on between two parties negotiating at arm's length are not swept into the statute. The 152 is primarily concerned with the integrity of the process. And process is, and what it's really trying to get at is situations, for example, in which a debtor tries or creditor tries to bribe the trustee or some officer of the court. It's trying not to capture all of the instances in which people may be negotiating at arm's length, possibly represented by counsel. So it's deliberately trying to get at that core of the bankruptcy process.
Let me ask you, was her debt non-dischargeable?
That was a matter of contention, Your Honor.
Well, how was it resolved, or was it resolved?
It was never resolved. He filed a adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court looking for a declaration that it was dischargeable. She then filed a separate proceeding arguing that it was not dischargeable because it was in the nature of maintenance or alimony. They were litigating that issue when all of this happened.
I guess, fortunately, we don't have to resolve the bankruptcy as part of this. So.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does the dischargeability of it have any bearing on this case?
On the question of the bankruptcy fraud, Your Honor, or on the case generally?
Anything in the case.
Your Honor, it's. I think that it, honestly, I don't know.
If it's dischargeable, it's hard to see. Hard to see what the. If it's dischargeable, I don't. He wouldn't have any expected monetary gain, would he?
If it was dischargeable, which is what he'd been arguing all along, then I don't think he would have caused any harm at all, even to her.
Well, it could cause harm to her. Wouldn't be of any benefit to him, right?
Right.
Wouldn't it be? Yeah.
No.
It would be a spite thing. It would be intended loss rather than intended gain or something. I don't know.
Not even sure that there would be intended loss or intended gain in that instance. And certainly he was very vociferous in arguing before the bankruptcy court that it was not.
These ancillary proceedings you mentioned, was there any discussion of that by the judge?
No, Your Honor. And the way that the evidence...
The way the evidence
was presented, it appeared from the record that no one fully appreciated the difference between a case under Title 11 and other kinds of ancillary proceedings, which the Bankruptcy Code refers to as proceedings arising under Title 11 or proceedings related to Title 11. And so when the government presented its evidence, it made the argument that it must simply prove that a proceeding under Title 11 existed.
Well, did Peel contest this, or is this like the affirmative defense? Is this something that just...
It's like the affirmative defense,
came up,
Your Honor.
On appeal.
This should be a plain error issue. Our argument, however, is that it is plain from the face of the statute that these particular matters were not cases under Title 11 as required.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And Ms. Liu, you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of this.
Thank you.
We'll move on.